Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
white dwarf stars. White dwarf stars are, I suppose, the most famous stars, perhaps not the nearest, is, I think it's 13.6 light years away, is Sirius B. It's a very small star, co-orbiting or orbiting, with a binary system of Sirius A, Sirius B. So Sirius is, I suppose the, common name, the, familiar name, so Alpha Centauri or Sirius, the dog star, the brightest star in the sky. Sirius is a blue giant. Sirius A is a blue giant. And next to it is a white dwarf. Now, what's prompted me to do this is a quick. Now, firstly, you can hear me breathing, but it's not as bad. I've just come up the slope. I'm on a flat slope, slowly getting my breath. So, and these podcasts are done while I'm doing cardiac rehab walk. So it gets my cognitive stuff going as well as walking. So that's the aim of it. Now, why am I doing white dwarfs? Well, I think they're poorly explained, quite honestly. To be honest, as they say. So I read a Cosmos magazine article from last year, just skimming over it. White dwarfs are interesting, and they were saying that they were picking up rotation radiation off a white dwarf as it filled up its partner star. So let's put it here. So, if I look at night and I count 10 stars, what our astronomy is telling us, that you've counted 12 planets. There'll be at least 12 planets there, if not many, many more. We know conservatively that for every 10 stars, there's 12 planets. And there's a few systems without planets now, and that seems to be the harder they look, the more planets they find. But there's a good fraction of systems out there are binary star systems, and binary star systems tend to throw off their planets. At least this is what we know, and so we can actually start to pick up all these planets, planets out there. And a good fraction of stars are binary star systems. A good fraction of white dwarfs are not just sitting by themselves. They're orbiting another star. And what they've observed, probably beginning to observe a few outliers in the white dwarf world. One is white dwarfs spinning and emitting radiation. White dwarfs with, well, there's one, I think it's 2 years ago, discovered with a pure 96% oxygen atmosphere on it. So that surface layer coming off it has very few hydrogen lines coming off it, but very strong oxygen lines. So you can imagine picking this one up in your telescope, this will just stick out like anything. It'll be most head-scratching one to look at. This is white dwarfs, and the series of statements about them are well, just not necessarily that. I don't know. I suppose easy to understand. So the white dwarf, where you look at the majority of stars in space, they're mostly hydrogen, 25% helium by by decree by the, from the Big Bang. So the Big Bang cooked the hydrogen first couple of minutes and cooked up half the hydrogen. Well, half the hydrogen went into heliums, but it takes four hydrogens to make one helium. So as it was going over to be a helium universe, these things produce, thank goodness, there's some hydrogen around the place. At four hydrogens and one helium, it's 50-50. It just went over 50%, more than 50% of the mass of the universe is in helium. Okay, most of the 75% of the, or the 80% of the universe is hydrogen. 23% is helium, around that. I really can't remember. And that hydrogen was getting stacked together rather quickly. And so most of your stars are hydrogen and helium. And as they burn, they go in a cycle, eventually, we're not just making hydrogen into helium. So it's all, we're in the dim afterglow of the bang. There's a system where helium is bolted together. It's called the CNO cycle. And stars of a certain size go into it and start, they don't necessarily produce carbon. They produce a contaminant of carbon. A contaminant of carbon is like a burn enhancer. And so this is, our sun is getting its burn enhancer, getting a bit of carbon at its core, getting a little bit hot. I think 1% of all the radiation comes from a carbon cycle. And the carbon cycle is, it's called the CNO cycle. So it's carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. Each time a proton is added to it, when it wants to go after oxygen, it breaks off. It goes back to carbon, giving you helium. So it produces helium. But in a cycle. Now, thing doesn't produce carbon as a catalyst. So carbon is not consumed. Well, it's consumed and then regenerated. So the cycle produces heaps of helium and just reuses its carbon. And no oxygen or nitrogen is produced in any quantity, because these are radioactive nitrogen and unstable oxygen and nitrogen. It's oxygen 15, which is radioactive, doesn't hang out the place. So these stars go on, and as this goes on, the cycle builds up and knocks over, and the amount of carbon builds up, and eventually you get a fairly good quantity of carbon produced. The cycle really takes off, and the helium, you get a triple helium process. And there's a triple helium process in our sun. That's how our sun got its carbon. It's getting its carbon. It's got a very slow triple helium process. So helium is two protons, two neutrons. Three of them is four protons, three. Sorry, it's six protons, six neutrons makes up a carbon nucleus. Now, there's a bit of a trick to it in terms of that the when it's put it together, the carbon is just a smidge above. So the sort of assembled carbon, because it's pretty hot there, so assembled carbon giving you heaps of energy, assembled carbon is a little bit above the energy level of the stable carbon. And so rather than build up, fall apart, build up, it falls apart back into stable carbon. So this stable carbon enters the process, and your sun burns, and essentially it's burning hydrogen, and the CNO process is also burning hydrogen more efficiently. But when it runs out of hydrogen, it starts to burn its helium orbit to different efficiencies. You get carbon building up, and this special competing processes which are temperature dependent and unstable. So you can get flashes as the density changes, the temperature changes, and it shifts over to a different style of burning. It means heat is coming out. Now, the heat is kinetic energy, I suppose light energy, but kinetic energy, and so it's stopping things going down. It's a bit like a hot air balloon. The hot air is going up and pushing out. So once the heat goes from it, and there's also a small radiation pressure there. I don't know whether the radiation pressure is very significant in a star our size, but much bigger. There's a fairly thumping radiation pressure. This is the actual photons have a kick going out. The photons want to get out of the star, and so when they get out, they kick the star back in. I've just really got to think, because I don't know how this actually works, because photon pressure would actually kick down, applying a pressure into the star as the photon finally gets away. Oh, yeah, that's the oh yeah, so it's H bar, HF is the frequency, and I think it's H on lambda, so it's the bigger, the shorter the wavelength, you actually get some momentum exchange there. I've just got to really think that through. Now that I'm saying, I can't really picture it in my head. Oh, just thinking through as I'm walking. Well, you've got to see. So you've got these processes going along, and you get a full supernova. You can get things very close to it, and the formation of a planetary nebula. And planetary nebula means cloud. And what people used to go up in space, and they'd see this diffuse gas in a big body. And indeed, it's not that it's not a cloud, it is a cloud. It's a cloud of gas, it's a star which has blown out its layer. And these nebula are these very colourful things, very thin, luminous gas, like a lampshade. So they're luminous, not because they're burning. The light is actually reflecting and absorbing and re-emitting radiation from the central power source. So you've got a very bright star in the centre, illuminating the whole nebula. There's a source, or you can get radio nebula, where the star is producing a lot of radio energy. So low energy or high energy nebula can be powered by different ways, but the nebula is basically a huge neon sign. And how a nebula operates is the conservation of momentum. As the star implodes, it explodes. You just can't have an explosion. You've got to have implosion with explosion. There's conservation of momentum, even on Earth, right? If I have a bomb, bomb equally implodes as it explodes. It's part of its way that these things operate. There's only a shell on the outside. Well, it is, so the outer side of the star is its shell, and the shell blows up and it leaves you with this carbon core. Now, this is a very high gravitational field. Now, we experience gravity of the Earth 6,000 kilometers from the core, so that's 1/6,000 squared meters, or 6 million meters. So that's so the gravitational field of even our Earth would be incredibly high, crushingly high, if we could compress the Earth down. We could get down closer to the center of the Earth. So this is one of the things, is that these a very high mass, and they're very high mass, very small radius, and the gravitational field or pressure or the gravitational force is m, the mass of the star, which will be this. I think it's, you can make one of these dwarfs, I think 1.1 solar masses. That's now starting off there, you have to have something 2 or 3 times our solar mass, because the process of making white dwarf is very messy. It creates all this, was off this gas. So as much matter goes away from the white dwarf as goes in there. But the gravitational field is very intense, though. The gravitational field is our sun, the volume, our mass of our sun, inside the radius of our Earth. So white dwarfs, pulsars are neutron stars the size of New York City would be a reasonably good neutron star. But a white dwarf is something the mass of our sun pushed into a radius of, or a ball the size of our Earth. So our Earth and our sun is, forget now, these stars are very hot, and so they're very bright. So we would, we would see, say if we had a white dwarf instead of our sun, it would be very dim, right? Because there'd be a thousandth the size. So it's 1/100th the width, 1/100th the height, 100 times 100,000th the size. That little dot would itself be intensely, burningly bright. So if we got our telescope, and compared to looking at through our sun, it would actually burn us through. So it's very bright. Sort of like the difference between a laser pointer is very bright. You got a stage light, which is 100 watts. A laser, which is milliwatts, can still be seen because it's very concentrated. It's very bright. That's the amount of energy coming through it. Now what's happening here is that this process is, there's no longer any heat generated within it. There's no more fusion going on, but the radiation is trapped inside it. And so it's just lost its surface area. It's really compressed now. I don't know. People say it is a diamond. When it chills down, it's hard to say what. So obviously the spacing between nuclei is, what is it? It have to be 1/100th, at least 1/100th of the spacing of nuclei is. It's really compressed down. It's like if I compress something, I could at most compress steel by, 1/3 with the most imaginable force, but compress it by 100, it's really compressed, because the gravitational field is really big, and the gravitational force is so big, because I've actually crushed it down. I've got that r squared, one, so it's a hundredth its size, so that's one on ten, it's 10,000 times as great. So, what could I say? If I hold something up, 5 meters, it'll take 1 second to drop down. So generally it takes, if you jump out of the second story, third story window, roughly second story window, 5 meters off the ground, you've got a second before you, because that's, a half GT squared. T is 1, G is 10, half is 5 meters, roughly 5 meters, going down. Now, if we, do the same theme, where, the gravitational fields, 100 down, you, in terms of, it takes you a second to drop, if you just put it through, it takes you a hundredth of a second to drop that distance, and you'd be squashed as a pancake on its surface. So that's your field. Now, what happens is that, now we know what's inside stars, like, because it's like you can tell what's actually inside your slow cooker. You stick your ladle in, you convect it up, and we got a very good view, because these stars, to supernova, they just, it's like bop, the whole thing inverts and there's pressure waves. But there's these other stars, which are very large, and it's called horizontal main branch stars, old stars, and what they do is they turn over, and the core goes to visit the surface of the star, so you can actually see what's in the star from from this process. So I'm just having a good look around here, because I'm a bit off on the trip. What was going on there? These large stars, they are just sort of, imagine they're heaving. So it's sort of like, what's your stomach contact? You're almost sick, and a little bit of it goes in your mouth. Of course, something is wrong here. I've missed the path. Okay. It's pretty dangerous. I wonder. Okay, so we can see here, and so as these stars go along, we can, and they, all these stars go off into black holes anyway, so we've lost them, but it's sort of like this diagnostic. We can have a really good look at stars, and eventually, as you're a gourmand, you can taste the food, smell the food. We can actually smell the light of a star with a spectrometer, and we can sort of sniff out oxygen, sniff out neon and all that type of stuff. And as these stars go, you can actually produce a lot of stars which are high in oxygen as the process really kicks on. They're a bit more exotic. So the majority of your white dwarfs are carbon. Yeah, that's it. They're, I think, of carbon out there. But what happens is that it's like anything. The carbon's denser, it goes to the bottom. And so they'll have a layer of helium and a layer of hydrogen on them. So they'll look like a hydrogen star, but underneath it we know that they're carbon. Or they can be in not such a loving relationship with another star. and the hydrogen can be blown off them. So it's a pretty hair-raising prospect. I don't know what it goes to the metals. I assume the metals would instead would go right into the core, so the very center of the core would be pretty irony and stuff like that. I don't know how much the iron tends to get smashed out in supernova into iron dust. You know, we're a little piece of supernova fragment. You know, we're the Earth's got a bit of iron. I think it's only 7% iron. It's 20% magnesium. Huge percentage of silicon. You know, we're sort of a magnesium, oxygen and silicon planet. A bit of iron on the inside. We've sort of kept the nowhere to pick up iron deposits. I just don't know exactly how the iron deposits form on Earth, but majority of the Earth is just your vanilla garden rock. You know, you pick up a rock, and it's, you know, silicon, oxygen, yeah, sand, yeah, sand with magnesium in it, and sort of the heavier stuff is on the seafloor. But so majority of your white dwarfs are not much happening. But what they're discovering now is that they're spinning and have magnetic fields locked into them, and now the thing is that that's a star spinning's got a lot of angular momentum locked into it. It's got its magnetic field locked into it. I find this a bit crazy to understand, but these stars, these white dwarfs, can still be pumping out a heap of high energy radiation. So some of these processes step over the thermal processes, so they produce X-rays, you know, possibly not right across the spectrum, on a fairly narrow range of the X-ray spectrum, and it will put it out exactly. Ultimately, everything has to be in thermal equilibrium, but it's how those thermal equilibriums lock together you get some pretty unusual things. So this is what they're discovering. They're discovering a few outlier white dwarfs. Now, something which makes me really angry. People say, there must be black dwarfs out there when the white dwarfs run out of energy. And if you plug in the numbers, the universe isn't old enough for any black dwarfs. Or if we do see a black dwarf, we've got to say, oh, well, that's definite. That's a definite God. God's a bit messy, left one over from the last universe. Yeah, something's... That'll be big news if it was found a black dwarf. And they could possibly see it. You could see a black dwarf, well, I suppose, because you'd get lensing. And so what's happening, well, this is gravitational lensing, is besides these bodies, because they're producing light, and the light, it gives you the flavour of the matter and the brightness and the surface, it all hooked together that the lightness comes across. But then you get these other bodies which are completely dark, and it's sort of like jelly balls going in your liquid. You can't see it directly, but you can see refractive, it's sort of like a mirage, a gravitational mirage. Some of these dark bodies go ahead. So, it's not degenerate. It's on the way to being a a black hole, or generate neutron stars. That's where and there's these weird things called quark stars. I don't know whether I quite frankly don't have enough knowledge or experience to make any comment on that. You've got all those different weird things going out, but you can actually see these things doing micro lensing events. Now, what happens is that previously you'd have to, if one of these micro lensing events happened, you know, once every 1,000 years on a star, you have to be very lucky. But now they've got the telescopes, which are equivalent to, they've got such good precision that they can take in tens of thousands of stars at once and look at them simultaneously and continuously and just lock them in. And so they begin to see some of these little dark horses walk across. So, yeah, in general, I suppose the point that I get is that the white dwarfs are interesting, but the white dwarfs are all on the inverse square of Newton's universal law of gravitation, or the inverse square. It actually can compress it down, and the actual surface gravity goes right up as you compress it. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.